Summing up the reign of Israel's first king, 1 Chronicles 10 tells us, "So Saul died for his unfaithfulness. He was unfaithful to the Lord, in that he did not keep the command of the Lord, and also consulted a medium, seeking guidance, and did not seek guidance from the Lord. Therefore the Lord slew him, and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. Saul did not, however, begin his reign unfaithful to the Lord. In fact, given his druthers, it seems that he would have preferred not to have begun his reign at all. Saul started out as a reluctant king, but that didn't last. Our Wyoming Catholic College freshmen, after 3 weeks in the wilderness, studying God's first book, the Creation, come back for their first semester and study God's second book, the Bible, beginning in the fall with the Old Testament. Dr. Jeremy Holmes has been leading students through the history of God's chosen people for years now, and he always pauses to discuss the short, troubled, and troubling reign of King Saul. When they entered the Promised Land, Israel had no king. That job belonged to God, who then appointed judges. How did they end up with a king instead?
The period of the judges did not work out very well for them. They were constantly under the thumb of their neighbors, once in a while being liberated for a brief time by some charismatic individual who would rise up under the inspiration of the Spirit. But these individuals declined in quality as the years went on. We went from Deborah, the amazing woman judge prophet who would sit under the palm tree and everyone would come to her to have their problem solved, to, Samson by the end, who was a sort of lone ranger judge, never worked with anyone, and frankly, a little unsavory. I wouldn't want my daughter to date Samson. And by the end of the period of judges, we have bizarre things happening, like the rape of this man's concubine, and he chops her into 12 pieces and sort of mails her body all over to the tribes to gather them to exterminate the tribe of Benjamin, which they nearly do. The chaos has set in at the end of this period, and it's clear that something needs to change. But when the people approach God and ask about a change, the way they couch their request is not the way I just did. They don't say, things have been descending into chaos and nobody worships correctly. They say, we want to be like all the other nations and have a king to lead us in and out. And after some warnings and shaking of his divine finger, God gives them what they asked for.
Yeah, the last judge, Samuel, warned them about kings. Why were kings a bad idea?
What God explicitly says is that in asking for a king, they're rejecting God as king over them. And that's an interesting point. Israel has been this completely unique situation where there are a kind of federation of tribes, but there is no visible, tangible head. Their head simply is God, whereas the nations around them have a visible, tangible king. And getting a king, they immediately come to look more like the nations around them. And I think that's one general problem, is instantly they start to feel like we are, as they wanted to be, more like the nations around them. But Samuel also has his specific list, right? The king is going to need taxes. A king is someone with a standing bureaucracy and a standing army. Somebody has to pay for that, and it's going to be you people. A king actually needs people to staff his bureaucracy and his army. That's going to be your sons and daughters, the best ones. The luxury of a king can become so burdensome that eventually the people will cry out to God to sort of save them from their king. And God says, in that day, when you cry out, I'm not going to save you. It's your king now. You have to pay the taxes and give him your kids.
Now, how did they get Saul?
Now, that's a funny thing. It's a weird story. So Saul goes chasing his father's donkeys who have gotten lost and wanders across the countryside, happens by a town where the prophet Samuel is staying, and
stops in because he thinks maybe if he could ask a prophet, he could find his donkeys. Well, Samuel has just been waiting for him to show up, ready to anoint him as king, and catches him at a private moment when they're all alone and anoints him. And as a reader, you think, okay, I guess Saul is king now. But no. Actually, then Samuel gathers the people together and they draw lots. This sort of, you know, it's like rolling the dice, right? They cast lots to pick a tribe, then to pick a family within the tribe, then to pick the subfamily within that family, and eventually to pick an individual, and it's Saul. And they, you know, great, it's Saul, and look around and they can't find him. It turns out he's hiding amongst the bags, you know, that everyone has piled up. He's hiding from what he already knows is going to happen, because he had that conversation earlier. And being forewarned at sort of how the lots are going to turn out, he's hiding from this appointment as king. But they drag him out. He's head and shoulders taller than everybody, and he's really handsome. And Samuel says, look, this is your king. Doesn't he look great? And they sort of shrug and go on with life for a while. And some people don't even accept him as king at first, until there's a battle. And when Saul wins a battle, then everyone says, okay, he's king. So it's funny. You expect his anointing to be the end of the story, now he's king. But actually, he has to become king by a kind of mundane process of selection, and then by the even more mundane process of going out and whipping the Philistines.
Well, there's something to that. A leader has to prove himself.
Right. Yeah. You know, perhaps reading the Bible, you know, getting into a pious mindset, we think, if God's behind you, you have nothing to prove. Well, not so.
How does kingship change Saul? Are there changes in his character, or does his character stay the same, only become more extreme? What goes on?
When he begins, he's that tall, good-looking guy who's hiding in the baggage, and you think, what does that say about him? He's hiding in the baggage. Well, it says, at a minimum, he's fearful. You might say humble, but I think we would have to say a little more harshly, he's afraid of being king. Once he's made king, however, we do see, in a way, a change, but in a way, it all stays the same. We start to see it in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, when they're gathering for a battle for the Philistines, and he's agreed to meet Samuel on a given day, and Samuel will offer the sacrifice necessary before they go into battle. Samuel is not there on time, and they delay, and Saul starts to see his army slip away, and he gets afraid. And so he offers the sacrifice himself instead of following the agreement that he had made with Samuel. Samuel shows up at that moment, demands to know what's going on, and basically tells him by doing this, he has ensured that his dynasty is not going to last. He's not going to have a sort of long succession of sons who will be king. But what we learn about Saul here is he did what was supposed to happen, that the sacrifice was supposed to take place, but he did it the wrong way. And he did it the wrong way because he was afraid. And so we see that fear still driving him here. He's still the guy who hid behind the baggage. But the next step, I think, is where it starts to get interesting. In chapter 15, he has been commanded by God through Samuel to go kill the Amalekites, kill the Amalekite king, kill everything, take no prisoners, take no booty, destroy everything. Well, he comes back, and he's got all the best animals, and he's got the king alive. And Samuel meets him and says, why did you not do what God said to do? And he says, I did. I obeyed the Lord's command. And Samuel's response is classic. Then what is the sound of bleating I hear? You know, like, oh, yeah, the animals. Saul has to think on his feet and says, we kept the animals to sacrifice to the Lord. Yeah. And which does not explain the king, of course. And eventually, after some hemming and hawing, he breaks down and admits, the people wanted to keep the animals, and so he caved. He feared the people. Well, this is interesting. Now we're starting to see Saul, because he's afraid, he needs the people's support. So he's going to keep his ear to the wind, you know, and do kind of what he thinks the people's will is going to be drifting towards. And so we're starting to see him not afraid of being king, but clutching the kingship. Now he's trying to hold on to his authority with a kind of white-knuckled fear. It keeps going.
When David enters the story, everybody's scared of Goliath,
right?
Except David.
Yes.
Kills Goliath, and now he's taken into Saul's palace to be Saul's chief general.
Right.
And then it doesn't take very long before Saul is afraid of him.
Yes, that incident when he did not do the Lord's command with the Amalekites led Samuel to say, not just that his dynasty won't last, but he himself personally is going to be replaced by one of his neighbors, by someone nearby. A man after the Lord's own heart, is what Samuel says. So Saul knows in the back of his mind that he's up for replacement. And when we get this rising star, and they return from battle one day, and the people in the streets are shouting, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, instantly Saul is afraid of him, and actually starts working for his death, starts trying to kill him. Which again is an interesting reaction, given that he already knows that God's will is that Saul be replaced. But Saul is starting to work to prevent himself from being replaced. Of course, this turns into a kind of Coyote and Roadrunner show eventually, with David running through the mountains and Saul chasing him around. We've got these scenes where Saul is on one side of the mountain and David's on the other side of the mountain. They're circling around, keeping on opposite sides. David is hiding in caves and behind trees, and Saul eventually encounters him in a cave. This is a protracted effort to kill David. But in that scene where he meets David in the cave, and David spares his life, David won't take Saul's life, and eventually reveals himself to Saul, Saul admits that he knows God is going to make David king. He knows it. He knows that David is the anointed. He knows what's going down. Next chapter, we're back to Coyote and Roadrunner. He's chasing David through the hills, trying to kill him. And in other words, his fear has driven him first to do the right thing the wrong way, then to disobey a command. Now he's into a sustained attempt to thwart God's will. He knows what it is, and he's working and working and working to stop it.
Well, and then we have the incident with the witch at Endor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that seems to be the next step, right? That as Saul is going from bad to worse, after his attempts to kill David, it says that the spirit of the Lord departed from him, and an evil spirit from the Lord came on him, and he acts, today we would say, mentally unstable. At a random moment, he'll try to pin somebody to the wall with a spear, either David or his own son, Jonathan. In this growing separation from God, it gets to the point that he'll take the usual means that a king would take to get some word from God, consulting the priests with their sacred Urim and Thummim, or trying to consult a prophet, and there is no word. He can't get any word. Samuel is long dead. He can't go to Samuel, and he's got a big battle with the Philistines coming up, and he's terribly anxious to know what's going to happen. He needs to know. Well, there we have it again. His fear, right? He needs to know because he's afraid. He needs to reassure himself that things are going to be okay. Or if they're not, then he needs to know so he can prepare himself. And so he just decides, if God won't talk to me, I will by golly get a message. And he goes to a medium to call Samuel up from the dead. It's a creepy scene, Saul disguises himself so that she won't know. It would be an awkward thing to meet Saul as a medium, because he's been, earlier in his life, he was trying to stamp out all the wizards and mediums and witches from the land, right? But here he is, consorting with God's enemy, the people he himself tried to stamp out earlier. So he's gone from doing the right thing the wrong way to just doing the wrong thing, to a sustained attempt to thwart God's will, to allying with God's enemies, all driven by this fear, the fear which turns into a need to take things into his own hands. He needs to ensure for himself how things are going to turn out. He can't let it go and let God take care of it for him. He has to offer the sacrifice himself. He has to kill David. Now he has to drag Saul up from the underworld.
Samuel.
Drag Samuel up from the underworld to get the message that he needs to reassure himself. And the message is not good, right? The message is you're going to die. The next step is Saul's utter destruction.
Yeah, well, he's fatally wounded and then commits suicide.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be killed by one of the uncircumcised, and he falls on his own sword. So he ends up, in the end, literally destroying himself. It's a story of a guy who starts as a kind of almost lovably flawed country boy. He's big, he's strong, he's handsome. He's even good in battle. He's got some merits as a leader. But he's fearful. And that fear widens and widens and widens until he's turned into a monster and utterly destroys himself.
Well, and his army as well, because they lose very badly to the Philistines in that last battle.
Yes. Now, of course, David was not involved in that battle.
Right.
David has been hiding from Saul. David, in the meantime, this is a study in contrast, of course. David is the one who refuses to take things into his own hands. He won't force outcomes. When Saul's right in front of him, and helpless, he won't kill him and take the kingship. There's a neat moment when David has been really offended by a guy named Nabal. They just really treated him like dirt. And David straps on his armor and tells the boys to get together, and they're going to go do Nabal in. Nabal's wife meets David and talks him down. And then he thanks her and says, you know, you prevented me from taking things into my own hands. You know, like, his character is he lets God take care of things. And it's just amazing the degree to which he can do that. And you realize he can go against everything the people with him want. They're all urging him to kill Saul, right? He can let go and let God, because at the end of the day, he's not afraid. It all goes back to when we meet David with the battle with Goliath. He just has this unshakable confidence that God is on his side. God was going to take care of things. And because God... he has this core that isn't blowing in the wind. And Saul just never had that relationship with God. He never had that core. And it undid him in the end.
Now, what do our students take away theologically or spiritually from the story of Saul?
Within 1 Samuel, the big picture is something like this. The people come to reject God as king over them. They say, we want to be like all the other nations. And then they say, we want a king to lead our armies in and out. In other words, they want to follow the people around them, and they want a kind of visible, tangible insurance, a reassurance that they'll be okay against their enemies. Well, what they get is Saul, who listens to the people around him and needs tangible assurance to allay his fears. In other words, they get a king who thinks of the kingship the same way they do. They get exactly the king they deserve, and it does not turn out well. David is the king they never deserved. That's a good sign, right? That is, they have done wrongly, but having shown them where their own desires go, God is going to offer his grace to the situation. More broadly, zooming out even more, we can say, in the long run, the kings aren't going to work out. Saul is a good presage of what happens. David was amazing. Solomon's pretty good, but it's a long and bitter story to exile from there. But the period of Judges didn't work out either. So they've tried not having a king and having only God as their king. Then they've tried having a king, and neither one worked. And you say, it's almost like a demonstration that the situation is hopeless. We will never be able to work this out because God should be our king, but we need a man. But if we get a man, then we're rejecting God. And you think, how are we going to get to a situation where we can get a king, whereby choosing him as our visible king, we're not rejecting God? And you have to tune into the New Testament to find out what's the answer.
Well, it's a great place to stop during this Advent season. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
In Deuteronomy 17, God laid down rules for a future king over Israel. That king was, above all, to have a copy of God's law and to know it, quote, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment, neither to the right hand nor to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. Close quote. Leadership, whether in politics, the church, business, or families, is a perilous thing. What St. Augustine called libido dominandi, the desire to dominate others, is part of our fallen nature. As leaders, our first task is to stay close to God and to obey Him, taking our cues from David's greater son, whose birth we celebrate in a few weeks. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.